Support for WMFE comes from Embry-Riddle Aeronautical University's worldwide campus, where highly ranked online degree programs offer the flexibility to learn what students want from wherever they are. More at erau.edu/worldwide.
The impacts of Blue Origin's explosion and the ethics of human spaceflight. You're listening to Are We There Yet?, the radio show exploring space exploration. Hi, I'm Brendan Byrne. Blue Origin says it expects to fly its New Glenn rocket by the end of this year. That's after an explosion last week destroyed a rocket and damaged the company's launch facility at Cape Canaveral. Blue Origin plays a critical role in NASA's ambitious plans to return humans to the moon and build a permanent base on the lunar surface. Ars Technica's senior space editor Eric Berger joins us to talk about the damage done and how this might impact NASA's plans. Then, space exploration is dangerous and comes with risks and questions that run the gamut when it comes to ethics.
Is this risk to life and limb or to health within limits such that the risks are acceptable for the benefits that we hope to get?
We speak with Jeff Kahn, director of the Johns Hopkins Berman Institute of Bioethics, about the ethics of human space exploration. That's ahead on Are We There Yet? From Central Florida Public Media. An explosion Thursday at Blue Origin's launch facility at Cape Canaveral in Florida could be seen from miles away. Engineers with the company were conducting a pre-flight test of its New Glenn rocket. The explosion destroyed the rocket and caused significant damage to the pad. In an update Monday, Blue Origin CEO Dave Limp said the company was able to assess the damage, and it's not as bad as first thought. He says New Glenn will get back to flight by the end of this year. But there's still much work to be done, and any delay could impact NASA's ambitious plans to build a moon base and return humans to the lunar surface. Here to talk about the work ahead and the potential impact to NASA's Artemis program is Eric Berger, senior space editor at Ars Technica. Eric, welcome back to Are We There Yet?
Thanks, Brendan.
Hey, so lots to talk about. We did just get an update from Blue Origin's CEO, Dave Limp, on the social media platform X. Seems like good news. How do you read into that update?
I think it's a glass half full update. I do think it's significant that that the top line news is that they're going to fly or attempt to fly New Glenn before the end of the year. So that's less than 7 months from now. From a rebuilt facility at Launch Complex 36A. The good news that he shared was that the propellant farms, these are the large tanks and other vessels that hold propellant and otherwise, you know, keep the rocket fueled and before flight, is in good shape. That is important because it often can take months to source those items, and they're called long lead items. So that can take a long time. So if the propellant farm's in good shape, that's a win. He also mentioned that the transport erector, which was destroyed by and large, they do have a plan to actually, they had a plan to phase that out with some kind of new vertical movement system, which isn't entirely clear. So the fact that that's destroyed, they potentially have a workaround for that. So I think in their minds, they see a path to getting back to a launch site within 6 months. The glass half empty view, which I'm probably a little more partial to, is that the more realistic timeline is probably 12 to 18 months.
It's not just a rocket exploding. It is the launch infrastructure. You mentioned some of the things that that Dave mentioned that were okay, but really explain why this is such an important piece to flying a rocket is having this launch facility.
Yeah, in some ways, the loss of the rocket, you know, the failure investigation is really a minor part of the story. I think they can move through that fairly expeditiously. The main problem is that this was Blue Origin's only launch site. And so they have nowhere to launch the rocket from. They had done some preliminary work next door, but really that they hadn't gotten very far with that. So they're going to have to rebuild 36A. And some of the images that we've seen publicly, some of which have been shared privately, show some pretty serious damage to the concrete, you know, structure underlying it. So we don't know the health of the flame trench, the integrity of all of that structure, how deep that damage went. So they're going to have to spend some time looking at all of that in depth to see what needs to be rebuilt or what can be repaired or remediated. But you know, the ground infrastructure for a rocket is in some ways as complex as the rocket itself. You have all this intricate tubing to deliver all of these propellants to the rocket. You have large launch towers. You have obviously the transport erector. And it's kind of all this delicate ballet to get a rocket right out to the pad and basically not damage this all, even during a nominal launch. So it's very complex. There's plenty of the electricity, computers, and just all of, I think there's a lot more that goes into this. It's not just a big dumb metal tower, right? There's a lot of brains underlying it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, my only experience launching rockets is as a kid with model rockets, and you just stick it on that metal pole and fire the engine and it goes. But really, there is, as you mentioned, a lot of infrastructure there. Part of that infrastructure is a part of the launch tower that was damaged as well, right, Eric? The images looked gnarly when you first saw that, but it seems like they're going to be able to replace that, repair that in place. Tell us a bit about the launch tower itself and why that's so important.
Well, there's two of them, right? And one of them was knocked down. The other one appeared to have some pretty serious structural integrity issues. And I think they're saying that they can repair and rebuild it. Building towers actually is pretty straightforward. I think that's one of the more simpler parts of this. There's companies that can come out and build steel towers. So I think that may be lesser of an issue at some of the finer points of like all of the plumbing and wiring and so forth that goes into supporting a rocket launch. And one of the big questions I have is, does Blue Origin have all of the people to really surge in there to do this, the welders and so forth? If you think about, as Elon Musk was building up the Starbase facility in Texas, he was constantly trying to find more welders to come in and build things. There's a pretty fierce competition for technicians on the Space Coast, because you've got Stoke building a launch site, you've got Relativity building a launch site, you've got SpaceX building, their Starship launch towers and all their facilities. And so, Blue Origin has some people, but they're going to need more people. They're really going to want to move quickly on this.
Mm-hmm. You're listening to Are We There Yet from Central Florida Public Media. We're speaking with Eric Berger. He's the senior space editor at Ars Technica. We're talking about the Blue Origin explosion and their plan to get back to flight. Eric, we've been talking about the launch facility. What do we know about what actually happened to the rocket to cause the explosion in the first place?
Well, officially, we don't know anything. LIMP's note on this, Dave Limp, the CEO of Blue Origins, very conspicuously did not mention the cause of the anomaly. I've heard a couple of different things, but it does appear that one of the engines, one of the seven main engines at the base of New Glenn, failed in some way. At first, it looked like it might have been the center engine, but now I think it may be one of the other engines. Don't have any information on the cause of the failure, what ultimately happened, but obviously it raises concerns for New Glenn, but also the Vulcan rocket built, like United Launch Alliance, which also uses BE-4 engines in the first stage. Now, I will say that, the BE-4 has flown exceptionally well across a number of flights for Vulcan in the previous three flights on New Glenn. So my hope is that it's a relatively straightforward issue that they're able to identify. The fact that the rocket was on the ground, they have all this sensor data and all these camera data and imagery should really help them in the investigation to pinpoint the cause and find a solution.
Obviously, this will have to go through internal investigations from Blue Origin. Will the FAA have to step in and give them clearance to fly by the end of the year?
So here's what I've heard on that. NASA Administrator Jared Isaacman has told the company he's all in on supporting their efforts. Not surprising, since Blue Origin is now such a key player in both the moon base and the Artemis landings. Really critical to get this rocket and the lander and the Blue Moon lander going. The Space Force, as I understand it, has also really been supportive. I'm told that the president is ready to sort of lean on whatever regulatory agencies are standing in the way. So I do think that you will not see a protracted period of remediation of the site. I think Blue Origin's already in there starting work. And I just think that the kinds of environmental reviews and things that need to happen to get this vehicle will be expedited. So from a regulatory side, I think the company feels pretty good that it's going to get the support it needs. In some sense, that the rebuild of the 36A is on them. So there's no excuses other than sort of their ability to execute.
Mm-hmm. Eric, I believe it was a few months ago, Blue Origin suspended work on New Shepard, its suborbital space tourism rocket, to focus more on these kind of moon ambitions and New Glenn. Does moving that workforce here? Does that give them the leg up in a situation like this?
It helps, right? I mean, they had a launch site in West Texas where New Shepard flew from, much smaller, much simpler design, but certainly having those people, you know, move into the program helps. Good engineers, but I think at this point they've got lots of good engineering talent. It's more of the touch labor workforce that they're going to need help with.
You mentioned this before. NASA is relying on Blue Origin for its moon ambitions. We originally were supposed to chat on this show about NASA's moon base plans that were announced right before this anomaly last week. Bring us up to speed, Eric. How vital is Blue Origin to NASA's plans to put a moon base on there, and how might this slow things down?
It's really hard to overstate the contribution that Blue Origin was going to make. If you look at the Mark 1 lander, the small lander that they were hoping to fly later this year, you know, this is a vehicle capable of bringing about 1 to 3 tons to the lunar surface. And that is a factor of 10 greater than what any of the current private companies, the Astrobotics, the Intuitive Machines, the Fireflies, are all kind of in the 100 to 200 kilograms. So, you know, if you want to get rovers, you want to get equipment of any reasonable size to lunar surface over the next 3 to 4 years, you really need a blue moon to do it. So both for the first phase and the second phase of the moon base, you know, blue moon and its, you know, its design to launch on New Glenn, absolutely essential. At least until Starship gets flying regularly. But the nice thing about Blue Moon is it gets to the moon in one launch, right? Whereas Starship is going to require quite a few launches for refueling purposes. So Blue Moon was key. And then obviously, you know, Blue Origin needed to learn a lot from these early Blue Moon flights to inform its Blue Moon Mark II lander that's, you know, going to be very critical to getting humans back to the lunar surface alongside Starship as a human landing system. So it's a huge setback for NASA. They're losing lots of time with this rocket being down. It's a real gut punch to the whole program. Mm-hmm.
And for Artemis 3, which would stay in Earth's orbit and rendezvous with one or two of these landers, including Blue Origin's lander, what does that mean for Artemis 3? Are we still looking at the end of 2027, optimistically?
So I imagine there's been some really difficult discussions about that over the last 4 or 5 days. My understanding is that NASA is still pressing ahead with an Artemis 3 mission before the end of next year. As you know, they're having a crew announcement next week here in Houston. I'll be there for that, and that'll be quite interesting. We'll see if we can get more details about the architecture at that point. You know, I think NASA's in a really difficult spot here because you've got Blue Origin coming out today saying we're going to launch New Glenn before the end of this year, which, of course, would potentially have multiple blue moons in the next 12 months and allow for some kind of Blue Origin contribution to Artemis 3. I think internally, NASA probably doesn't believe that timeline is realistic. They probably have some real questions about a 6-month timeline, even a 12-month timeline return to flight seems pretty aggressive. And so they're probably pretty nervous. And I think there's some real discussions ongoing between NASA saying, hey, why don't we launch a couple of blue moons on Falcon Heavy? And you can get all the data on the blue moon performance from those test launches. And Blue Origin's probably over here saying, well, we really don't want to launch on a competitor's rocket. And we believe we're going to be ready in 6 months. And Blue Moon was optimized to fly on New Glenn, so we're going to stick to that plan. And so I think it's going to be really fascinating to watch that play out over the coming weeks and potentially months, because I do know there are senior people at NASA who are pretty skeptical about the Blue Origin timeline.
Lots to see, and I know you'll be covering it. Eric Berger is the senior space editor at Ars Technica. Eric, thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Brendan.
As Eric mentioned, NASA plans to announce the crew of Artemis 3 next week. We'll take a look at this crew and what their mission hopes to achieve. That's next week on Are We There Yet? Stay listening. But just ahead, the ethics of human spaceflight. That's coming up on Are We There Yet? You're listening to Are We There Yet? From Central Florida Public Media. I'm Brendan Byrne. Space exploration is dangerous and comes with risks and questions that run the gamut when it comes to ethics. Someone hoping to answer those questions is Jeff Kahn, director of the Johns Hopkins Berman Institute of Bioethics. He's featured on the latest season of Johns Hopkins' podcast on bioethics called Playing God. He joins us now to talk more about these complex questions. Jeff, welcome to Are We There Yet? This is going to be a simple question, but I'm sure a very complicated answer. What ethical questions do we have to ask ourselves when it comes to putting people in space for a very long time?
Very simple question, but you're right, quite a complicated answer, or set of answers, I guess, is really the way I would frame it. So one, I mean, we have to think about, you know, putting people on top of a rocket, on top of a bomb, and sending them off into space. But that's true for all human space flight. So the question really around long duration space flight has to do with what's different about that. And so, you know, the short answer to what's different is we can get people back from the space station in a few days. We can't get people back if we're on Mars or if we're en route to Mars. And so it changes the sort of the risk and benefit calculus in a way that requires a sort of a different paradigm about what we are willing to accept in terms of risk to individuals who we put in harm's way, in the sense of sending people into, you know, space counts as harm's way. The other thing, and I'll stop me if you want me to stop and talk more about any of these, but the other is radiation in very short answer, because we know a lot about radiation at the space station in low Earth orbit. We know a lot less about human health effects of radiation once we leave low Earth orbit. And there are limits on what NASA will permit in terms of how much dose, what kinds of radiation, how much people, astronauts are permitted to be exposed to as part of their performance of duties as an astronaut, and how can we live within those limits and still carry out these long duration missions.
You mentioned that you have to weigh this kind of equation of what is the risk, you know, what is the benefit of the risk that we are putting these astronauts in? Who is the we? Who is making that decision?
It's a really, really good question. So the sort of technical answer is NASA, but of course NASA is a government agency funded by the taxpayers of this country. So it has to be responsive to society at some level. But, you know, the actual do we go, do we not go, based on whatever we understand the risks to be, that lives with the chief medical officer of NASA, a guy named J.D. Polk, who gets a lot of input, but at the end of the day, he's the one who gets to decide, or needs to decide, is this risk to life and limb or to health within limits, such that the risks are acceptable for the benefits that we hope to get.
The risks of early space flight were far higher than the risks of space flight now. And even in between, when there was the space shuttle missions, there was also an increased risk of space exploration. How has, I don't want to say the space flight becoming more common, but we are doing it more often than we have in the past. How does that lead into this kind of risk equation you are making when it comes to putting astronauts at risk?
Yeah, I think a few things. One, you're right, there's more experience. So I think there's a higher level of confidence about what to expect and, you know, what the risks look like and how they can be managed and mitigated. But also there's a somewhat different tolerance for risk. There was a different, higher tolerance for risk in the early days of the space program than there is now. You know, the right stuff, right? I mean, everybody who cares about this area has read the book or seen the movie or probably both. And it's just not like that anymore, where you've got guys riding on motorcycles without helmets and doing all sorts of risky things. And those are the kinds of people who were willing to be strapped into rockets and shot into space. It's a different metric now, and there's a different expectation, and the agency doesn't demand that people, you know, be that kind of a risk seeker in order to be part of the astronaut corps.
What role does the public play in this, Jeff? You mentioned how, you know, we pay for NASA. We are part of that agency, right, as American taxpayers. J.D. Polk has the ultimate say, but public perception has to do with it too. I'm thinking back to the two space shuttle disasters, and the outcry of the American people for changes there. How does that public perception play into determining risk?
Yeah, I think that's a really, really good point. I think that the worry is we don't want that to happen. Of course, we don't want that to happen because of the loss of life, but it sets back the program as well. And so I think it's public perception after something bad happens. This is a little bit of a, how do we make sure that doesn't happen? So obviously we don't want the calamity of a disaster, but it also has implications for the program itself and how it, should or shouldn't go forward. I think what's really interesting about that question is we're entering a period where it's not just NASA that's making decisions about risk, right? We have private, companies who are engaging in space travel or thinking and planning about it, going beyond tourism to sending people into space, and whether they will be thinking differently about acceptable risks in a way that will push NASA to think differently. I think it's just an interesting open question.
You're listening to Are We There Yet? From Central Florida Public Media. I'm Brendan Byrne. We're speaking with Jeffrey Kahn, the director of the Berman Institute of Bioethics at Johns Hopkins University. We're talking about exploration and the ethics of human spaceflight. Jeff, is there a broad sense of ethics when it comes to spaceflight? I'm thinking of doctors have the Hippocratic Oath. Do spaceflight program managers have the same oath that they have to take to protect their astronauts?
I love that. No one's ever asked that. And I think it's a really interesting question. I think the short answer is no. Although, the people like J.D. Polk are not just, the chief medical officer of NASA, he's a flight surgeon as well. And flight surgeons are physicians. And so they are, bound in the same way that other physicians are bound. But I think beyond that, there isn't any kind of professional oath or, set of guidance that people who engage in decisions about sending people into space should feel or are bound by or should feel governed by. So interesting question, but maybe we ought to be thinking about what that should look like.
What about the astronauts? What role do astronauts play in making these decisions and determining these risk thresholds, if that's the correct term to say there? How do they play?
They have a big role to play, and they play it. So the astronaut corps is, of course, not a huge number of people, but they're highly selected. They're very smart. They're very educated. They're highly trained. So they have opinions, and they should. And they're the ones who, at the end of the day, are going to be experiencing the risks that we're talking about. There's a representative of the astronaut corps who gives input in all of these decisions and brings the view of the collective back to the decision makers. So it's very robust back and forth in my experience. I should say too, I chair one of the committees of the National Academies of Sciences, Engineering, and Medicine. That it's CAMI is the acronym, the Committee on Aerospace Medicine and Medicine of Extreme Environments. So I have the honor really of interacting with NASA staff and members of the astronaut corps. And so it's really interesting to see the interaction that happens. Astronauts want to fly. That's, of course, why they're in the astronaut corps. But they also are, very smart, measured people, and they want to make sure the decisions about how they fly are taken carefully and that their input is reflected.
Mm-hmm. I think one recent high profile example of that was the medical evacuation of the ISS when Mike Fink had an issue in orbit on the International Space Station. How has that particular incident played into how people like yourself and committees that you are on and NASA may be thinking about risk?
So one good takeaway there is that this was a foreseeable problem. I don't know the specifics of it, so I don't know exactly what went on, but they managed it in exactly the way that they, prepared for. What's an interesting question is, well, oh, that's great. From the ISS, you can do that. What about when we're on the moon? And when we're, what about when we're on Mars? And so, of course, once you're talking about going beyond low Earth orbit, especially if we're talking about asteroids and then onto Mars, you're going to have to manage these things in place. And so you're going to have the medical expertise, you're going to have the medical supplies, and you're going to have to be able to make decisions probably without the kind of support you're used to on the ground because of the length of time it will take, right, to get messages back and forth. So, you know, AI, all sorts of protocols, but it's going to be a different world as we send people further into space.
You know, finally, Jeff, you've outlined two really interesting frontiers that we are about to embark on. Humans to deep space, right? We're talking about on the moon for an extended period of time, heading to asteroids, heading to Mars, but also the rise of commercial space. We're looking at commercial space companies taking over in low Earth orbit. For you, as someone who thinks about, you know, astronaut safety and the ethics of doing this, what are some big questions that you are asking yourself as we enter this new frontier of human space exploration?
What are the commercial companies going to be willing to do that NASA has not and will not? And what do we do about that? So it's really interesting because there's all sorts of protections for workers on the ground, right? There's OSHA. I mean, there are all sorts of state level protections so that people who do risky things are protected. We don't have that for space. And so it's likely to be kind of a free for all for a while. And I think that's keeping people up at night because you'll be able to find people who will do risky things, right? There are enough people who want to go into space who are going to say, sure, I'll do that. Doesn't matter what the level of risk is, just, you know, show me where to sign up. One-way missions is another one. You know, when are we going to be willing to actually consider that, knowing, you know, whatever Mars One or whatever it was called, how real or not real that was. Supposedly there were many hundreds, if not thousands, of people who wanted to do that. And are we willing as a society to say, okay, I guess it's kind of like bungee jumping with a little more risk attached to it, right? You want to strap cords onto your ankles and dive off a bridge? Okay. But it feels a little bit different than that. If it's NASA, it feels a little bit more like that if it's a private entity.
That was Jeff Kahn, director of the Johns Hopkins Berman Institute of Bioethics and a recent guest on John Hopkins' latest season of the podcast, Playing God. That's going to do it for this week's show. If you're not already, be sure to subscribe to the show's podcast feed so you never miss an episode. Do that on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Stay connected with this show. Be sure to follow us on social media. You can find us on Instagram and Facebook. We're at AWTY Space. If you got an idea for a future episode of this show, or you want to join us as a guest, reach out. We're at arewetheryet@cfpublic.org. Are We There Yet? Is a production of Central Florida Public Media. Our producer is Marion Summerall. Editorial guidance comes from LaToya Dennis. Support for Are We There Yet? Comes from our listeners. Until next week, I'm Brendan Byrne. Thanks for listening.